for the occasional incident of vandalism or petty theft. There's no more hatred in the United States, at least among the cured. Only sporadic cases of detachment, but every medical procedure carries a certain risk. But so far, the government has failed to rid the country of the invalids, and it is the single blemish on the administration and the system in general. So, we don't talk about them. We pretend that the wilds, and the people who live there, don't even exist. It's rare to hear the word even spoken, except when a suspected sympathizer disappears, or when a young, diseased couple is found to have vanished together before a cure can be administered. One piece of really good news is this. All of yesterday's evaluations have been invalidated. All of us will receive a new evaluation date, which means I get a second chance. This time I swear I'm not going to screw it up. I feel completely idiotic about my meltdown at the labs. Sitting at the breakfast table with everything looking so clean and bright and normal, the chipped blue mugs full of coffee, the erratic beeping of the microwave, one of the few electronic devices besides the lights Carol actually allows us to use, makes yesterday seem like a long, strange dream. It's a miracle, actually, that a bunch of fanatical invalids decided to let loose a stampede at the exact moment I was failing the most important test of my life. I don't know what came over me. I think about glasses showing his teeth and the moment I heard my mouth say, "Gray," and I wince. Stupid, stupid. Suddenly I'm aware that Jenny has been talking to me. "What?" I blink at Jenny as she swims into focus. I watch her hands as she cuts her toast precisely into quarters. "I said, what's wrong with you?" Back and forth, back and forth. The knife dings against the edge of the plate. "You look like you're about to puke or something." "Jenny," Carol scolds. She's at the sink washing dishes. "Not while your uncle is eating breakfast." "I'm fine." I rip off a piece of toast, slide it across the stick of butter that's getting melty in the middle of the table, and force myself to eat. The last thing I need is a good old family-style interrogation. Just tired. Carol turns to look at me. Her face has always reminded me of a doll's, even when she's talking, even when she's irritated or happy or confused. Her expression stays weirdly immobile. "Couldn't sleep?" "I slept," I say. "I just had a bad dream, that's all." At the end of the table, my Uncle William starts up from his newspaper. "Oh, God, you know what? You just reminded me I had a dream last night, too." Carol raises her eyebrows, and even Jenny looks interested. It's extremely unusual for people to dream once they've been cured. Carol once told me that on the rare occasions she still dreams, her dreams are full of dishes, stacks and stacks of them climbing toward the sky, and sometimes she climbs them, lip to lip, hauling herself up into the clouds, trying to reach the top of the stack. But it never ends. It stretches on into infinity. As far as I know, my sister Rachel never dreams anymore. William smiles. "I was caulking the window in the bathroom. Carol, you remember I said there was a draft the other day? Anyway, I was piping in the caulk, but every time I finished, it would just flake away, almost like it was snow, and the wind would come in, and I'd have to start all over. On and on and on. For hours, it felt like." "How strange," my aunt says, smiling, coming to the table with a plate of fried eggs. My uncle likes them super runny, and they sit on the plate, their yolks jiggling and quivering like hula hoop dancers spotted with oil. My stomach twists. William says, "No wonder I'm so tired this morning. I was doing housework all night." Everyone laughs but me. I choke down another bit of toast, wondering whether I'll dream once I've been cured. I hope not. This year's the first year since sixth grade that I don't have a single class with Hannah, so I don't see her until after school when we meet up in the locker room to go running, even though cross-country season ended a couple of weeks ago. When the team went to regionals, it was only the third time I'd ever been out of Portland, and even though we went just 40 miles along the gray, bleak municipal highway, I could still hardly swallow. The butterflies in my throat were so frantic. Still, Hannah and I try to run together as much as we can, even during school vacations. I started running when I was 6 years old, after my mom committed suicide. The first day I ever ran a whole mile was the day of her funeral, I'd been told to stay upstairs with my cousins while my aunt prepared the house for the memorial service and laid out all the food. Marcia and Rachel were supposed to get me ready, but in the middle of helping me dress, they'd started arguing about something and had stopped paying me any attention at all. So I had wandered downstairs, my dress zipped halfway up my back, to ask my aunt for help. Mrs. Eisner, my aunt's neighbor at the time, was there. As I came into the kitchen, she was saying, "It's horrible, of course, but there was no hope for her anyway. It's much better this way. It's better for Lena, too. Who wants a mother like that?" I wasn't supposed to have heard. Mrs. Eisner gave a startled little gasp when she saw me and her mouth shut quickly like a cork popping back into a bottle. My aunt just stood there, and in that second, it was as though the world and the future collapsed down into a single point, and I understood that this, the kitchen, the spotless cream linoleum floors, the glaring lights, and the vivid green mass of jello on the counter was all that was left now that my mother was gone. Suddenly, I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stand the sight of my aunt's kitchen, which I now understood would be my kitchen. I couldn't stand the jello. My mother hated jello. An itchy feeling began to work its way through my body, as though 1,000 mosquitoes were circulating through my blood, biting me from the inside, making me want to scream, jump, squirm. I ran. Hannah, 1 foot on a bench, is lacing up her shoes when I come in. My awful secret is that I like to run with Hannah partly because it's the single, sole, solitary shred of a thing that I can do better than she can. But I would never admit that out loud in a million years. I haven't even had a chance to put my bag down before she's leaning forward and grabbing my arm. "Can you believe it?" She's fighting a smile, and her eyes are a pinwheel of color, blue, green, gold, flashing like they always do when she's excited about something. "It was definitely the invalids. That's what everybody's saying, anyway." We're the only people in the locker room. All the sports teams have finished their seasons, but I instinctively whip my head around when she says the word. "Keep your voice down." She pulls back a little, tossing her hair over one shoulder. "Relax. I did recon. Even checked the toilet stalls. We're in the clear." I open up the gym locker I've had for all my 10 years at St. Anne's. At its bottom is a film of gum wrappers and shredded notes and lost paper clips, and on top of that, my small, limp pile of running clothes, 2 pairs of shoes, my cross-country team jersey, 12 half-used bottles of deodorant, conditioner, and perfume. In less than 2 weeks, I'll graduate and never see the inside of this locker again. And for a second, I get sad. It's gross, but I've actually always loved the smell of gyms. The industrial cleaning fluid and the deodorant and soccer balls and even the lingering smell of sweat. It's comforting to me. It's so strange how life works. You want something and you wait and wait and feel like it's taking forever to come. Then it happens and it's over and all you want to do is curl back up in that moment before things changed. Who's everybody anyway? The news is saying it was just a mistake, a shipping error or something. I feel the need to repeat the official story, even though I know just as well as Hannah that it's BS. She straddles the bench watching me. As usual, she's oblivious to the fact that I hate it when other people see me change. "Don't be an idiot. If it was on the news, it definitely isn't true. Besides, who mixes up a cow and a box of prescription meds? It's not like it's hard to tell the difference." I shrug. She's right, obviously. She's still looking at me, so I angle slightly away. I've never been comfortable with my body, like Hannah and some of the other girls at St. Anne's. Never gotten over the awkward feeling that I've been fitted together just a little wrong in some very key places. Like I've been sketched by an amateur artist. If you don't look too closely, it's all right, but start focusing and all the smudges and mistakes become really obvious. Hannah kicks one leg out and begins stretching, refusing to let the issue drop. Hannah's more fascinated with the wilds than anyone I've ever met. If you think about it, it's pretty amazing. The planning and all that, it would have taken at least 4 or 5 people, maybe more, to coordinate everything. I think briefly of the boy I saw on the observation deck, of his flashing autumn leaf-colored hair, and the way he tipped his head back when he laughed so I could see the vaulted black arch of his mouth. I told no one about him, not even Hannah, Now I feel I should have. Hannah goes on. Someone must have had security codes, maybe a sympathizer. A door bangs loudly at the front of the locker room, and Hannah and I both jump, staring at each other with wide eyes. Footsteps click quickly across the linoleum. After a few seconds of hesitation, Hannah launches smoothly into a safe topic, the color of the graduation gowns, which are orange this year. Just then, Mrs. Johansson, the athletic director, comes around the bank of lockers, swinging her whistle around one finger. At least they're not brown like at Fieldston Prep, I say, though I'm barely listening to Hannah. My heart is pounding and I'm still thinking about the boy and wondering whether Johansson heard us say the word sympathizer. She doesn't do anything but nod as she passes us, so it seems unlikely. I've learned to get really good at this. Say one thing when I'm thinking about something else. Act like I'm listening when I'm not. Pretend to be calm and happy when really I'm freaking out. It's one of the skills you perfect as you get older. You have to learn that people are always listening. The first time I ever used the cell phone that my aunt and uncle share, I was surprised by the patchy interference that kept breaking up my conversation with Hannah at random intervals, until my aunt explained that it was just the government's listening devices, which arbitrarily cut into cell phone calls, recording them, monitoring conversations for target words like love or invalids or sympathizer. No one in particular is targeted. It's all done randomly, to be fair. But it's almost worse that way. I pretty much always feel as though a giant revolving gaze is bound to sweep over me at any second, lighting up my bad thoughts like an animal lit still and white in the ever-turning beam of a lighthouse. Sometimes I feel as though there are two me's, one coasting directly on top of the other, the superficial me who nods when she's supposed to nod and says what she's supposed to say, and some other deeper part, the part that worries and dreams and says, gray. Most of the time they move along in sync, and I hardly notice the split, but sometimes it feels as though I'm two whole different people and I could rip apart at any second. Once, I confessed this to Rachel. She just smiled and told me it would all be better after the procedure. After the procedure, she said, it would be all coasting, all glide, every day as easy as 1, 2, 3. Ready? I say, spinning my locker closed. We can still hear Mrs. Johansson shuffling around in the bathroom, whistling. A toilet flushes, a faucet goes on. My turn to pick the route, Hannah says, eyes sparkling, and before I can open my mouth to protest, she lunges forward and smacks me on the shoulder. Tag! You're it, she says, and just as easily spins off the bench and sprints for the door, laughing so I have to run to catch up. Earlier in the day it rained and the storm cooled everything off. Water evaporates from puddles in the streets, leaving a shimmering layer of mist over Portland. Above us, the sky is now a vivid blue. The bay is flat and silver, the coast like a giant belt cinched around it, keeping it in place. I don't ask Hannah where she's going, but it doesn't surprise me when she starts winding us toward Old Port, toward the old footpath that runs along Commercial Street and up to the labs. We try to keep on the smaller, less trafficked streets, but it's pretty much a losing game. It's 3:30, all the schools have been released, and the streets surge with students walking home. A few buses rumble past and one or two cars squeeze by. Cars are considered good luck. As they pass, people reach out their hands and brush along the shiny hoods, the clean, bright windows which will soon be smudged with fingerprints. Hannah and I run next to each other, reviewing all the day's gossip. We don't talk about the botched evaluations yesterday or the rumors of the invalids. There are too many people around. Instead, she tells me about her ethics exam, and I tell her about Cora Dervish's fight with Minna Wilkinson. We talk about Willow Marks, too, who has been absent from school since the previous Wednesday. Rumor is that Willow was found by regulators last week in Deering Oaks Park after curfew, with a boy. We've been hearing rumors like that about Willow for years. She's just the kind of person people talk about. She has blonde hair, but she's always coloring different streaks into it with markers. And I remember once on a freshman class trip to a museum, we passed a group of Spencer Prep boys, and she said so loud one of our chaperones could have easily heard, "I'd like to kiss one of them straight on the lips." Supposedly, she was caught hanging out with a boy in 10th grade and got off with a warning because she showed no signs of the deliria. Every so often, people make mistakes. It's biological, a result of the same kind of chemical and hormonal imbalances that occasionally lead to unnaturalism, to boys being attracted to boys and girls to girls. These impulses, too, will be resolved by the cure. But this time, it is serious, apparently, and Hannah drops the bomb just as we turn onto center. Mr. and Mrs. Marks have agreed to move the date of Willow's procedure up by a full 6 months. She'll be missing graduation day to get cured. 6 months? I repeat. We've been running hard for 20 minutes, so I'm not sure if the heavy thumping in my chest is a result of the exercise or the news. I'm feeling more out of breath than I should be, like someone's sitting on my chest. Isn't that dangerous? Hannah tips her head to the right, gesturing the way to a shortcut through an alley. It's been done before. Yeah, but not successfully. What about all the side effects? Mental problems? Blindness? There are a few reasons why the scientists won't let anyone under the age of 18 have the procedure, but the biggest one is that it just doesn't seem to work as well for people younger than that. And in the worst cases, it's been known to cause all kinds of crazy problems. Scientists speculate that the brain and its neuropathways are still too plastic before then, still in the middle of forming themselves. Actually, the older you are when you have the procedure, the better. But most people are scheduled for the procedure as close as possible to their 18th birthday. I guess they think it's worth the risk, Hannah says. Better than the alternative, you know. Amor deliria nervosa, the deadliest of all deadly things. This is the catchphrase that's written on every mental health pamphlet ever written about the deliria. Hannah's voice is flat as she repeats it, and it makes my stomach dip. All of yesterday's craziness has made me forget Hannah's comment to me before the evaluations. But now I remember, and remember how strange she looked too, eyes cloudy and unreadable. Come on. I feel a straining in my lungs and my left thigh is starting to cramp. The only way to push through it is to run harder and faster. Let's pick it up, slug. Bring it! Hannah's face splits into a grin, and both of us start pumping faster. The pain in my lungs swells up and blossoms until it feels like it's everywhere, tearing through all my cells and muscles at once. The cramp in my leg makes me wince every time my heel hits the pavement. It's always like this on miles 2 and 3, like all the stress and anxiety and irritation and fear get transformed into little needling points of physical pain, and you can't breathe or imagine going farther or think about anything but, I can't, I can't, I can't. And then, just as suddenly, it's gone. All the pain lifts away, the cramp vanishes, the fist eases off my chest, and I can breathe easily. Instantly, a feeling of total happiness bubbles up inside of me. The solid feeling of the ground underneath me, the simplicity of the movement, rocketing off my heels, pushing forward in time and space, total freedom and release. I glance over at Hannah. I can tell from her expression that she's feeling it too. She's made it through the wall. She senses me looking and whips around her blonde ponytail a bright arc to give me the thumbs up. It's strange. When we run, I feel closer to Hannah than at any other time. Even when we're not talking, it's like there's an invisible cord tethering us together, matching our rhythms, our arms, and our legs, as though we're both responding to the same drumbeat. More and more it has been occurring to me that this, too, will change after our procedures. She'll retreat to the West End and make friends with her neighbors, with people richer and more sophisticated than I am. I'll stay in some crappy apartment on Cumberland, and I won't miss her or remember what it felt like to run side by side. They've warned me that after my procedure, I may not even like running anymore, period. Another side effect of the cure, people often change their habits afterward, lose interest in their former hobbies and things that had given them pleasure. The cured, incapable of strong desire, are thus rid of both remembered and future pain. After the procedure. The Safety, Health, and Happiness Handbook, page 132. The world is spinning by, people in streets, a long, unfurling ribbon of color and sound. We run past St. Vincent's, the biggest all-boys school in Portland. A half dozen boys are outside playing basketball, lazily dribbling the ball around, calling to one another. Their words are a blur, an indistinct series of shouts and barks and short bursts of laughter, the way the boys always sound whenever they're together in groups, whenever you only hear them from around corners or across streets or down the beach. It's like they have a language all their own. And for about the thousandth time, I think how glad I am that segregation policies keep us separate most of the time. As we run by, I think I sense a momentary pause, a fraction of a second when all their eyes lift and turn in our direction. I'm too embarrassed to look. My whole body goes white hot like someone's just stuck me headfirst into an oven. But a second later, I feel their eyes sweeping past me, a wind latching on to Hannah. Her blonde hair flashes next to me, a coin in the sun. The pain is creeping back into my legs, a leaden feeling, but I force myself to keep going as we round the corner of Commercial Street and leave St. Vincent's behind. I feel Hannah straining to keep up next to me. I turn my head, barely managing to gasp out, "Race you!" But as Hannah pulls up, arms pumping and nearly passes me, I put my head down and lunge forward, cycling my legs as fast as I can, trying to suck air into my lungs, which feel like they've shrunk to the size of a pea, fighting the screaming in my muscles. Blackness eats the edges of my vision, and all I can see is the chain-link fence that rises up in front of us suddenly, blocking our path, and then I'm reaching out and thwacking it so hard it begins to shake, turning around to yell, "I won!" as Hannah pulls up a second behind me, gasping for breath. Both of us are laughing now, hiccuping and taking huge, gulping breaths of air as we pace around in circles, trying to walk it off. When she can finally breathe again, Hannah straightens up, laughing. "I let you win," she says, an old joke of ours. I toe some gravel in her direction. She ducks away, shrieking, "Keep telling yourself that." My hair has come out of its ponytail and I wrestle it out of its elastic, flipping my head down so I get the wind on my neck. Sweat drips down into my eyes, stinging. "Nice look." Hannah pushes me lightly and I stumble sideways, whipping my head up to swipe back at her. She sidesteps me. There's a gap in the chain-link fence that marks the beginning of a narrow service road. This is blocked with a low metal gate. Hannah hops it and gestures for me to follow. I haven't really been paying attention to where we are. The service drive threads down through a parking lot, a forest of industrial dumpsters and cargo storage sheds. Beyond those is the familiar string of white square buildings, like giant teeth. This must be one of the side entrances of the lab complex. I see now that the chain-link fence is looped on top with barbed wire and marked at 20-foot intervals with signs that all read, "Private property, no trespassing, authorized personnel only." "I don't think we're supposed to," I start to say, but Hannah cuts me off. "Come on," she calls out. "Live a little." I do a quick scan of the parking lot beyond the gate and the road behind us. No one. The small guard hut just past the gate is also empty. I lean over and peek inside. There's a half-eaten sandwich sitting on wax paper and a stack of books piled messily on a small desk next to an old-fashioned radio, which is spitting static and patchy bits of music into the silence. I don't see any surveillance cameras either, though there must be some. All the government buildings are wired. I hesitate for a second longer, then swing myself over the gate and catch up to Hannah. Her eyes are lit up with excitement, and I can tell that this was her plan and her destination all along. "This must be how the invalids got in," she says in a breathless rush, as though we've been talking about yesterday's drama at the labs all this time. "Don't you think?" "Doesn't seem like it would have been hard." I'm trying to sound casual, but the whole thing, the empty service road and the enormous parking lot shimmering in the sun, the blue dumpsters and the electrical wires zigzagging across the sky, the sparkling white slope of the lab roofs, makes me uneasy. Everything is silent and very still, frozen, almost the way things are in a dream or just before a major thunderstorm. I don't want to say it to Hannah, but I'd give pretty much anything to head back to Old Port, to the complex nest of familiar streets and stores. Even though there's no one around, I have the impression of being watched. It's worse than the normal feeling of being observed in school and on the street and even at home, having to be cautious about what you do and say, the close, blocked-in feeling that everyone gets used to eventually. Yeah! Hannah kicks at the packed dirt road. A plume of dust puffs up, resettles slowly. Pretty crappy security for a major medical facility. Pretty crappy security for a petting zoo, I say. I resent that. The voice comes from behind us, and both Hannah and I jump. I spin around, the world seems to freeze for an instant. A boy is standing behind us, arms crossed, head cocked to the side. A boy with caramel-colored skin and hair that's a golden brown color, like autumn leaves getting ready to fall. It's him, the boy from yesterday from the observation deck, the invalid. Except he isn't an invalid, obviously. He's wearing a short-sleeved blue guards uniform over jeans, and he's got a laminated government ID clipped to his collar. I leave for 2 seconds to get a refill, he gestures to the bottle of water he's holding, and I come back to find a full-fledged break-in. I'm so confused, I can't move or speak or do anything. Hannah must think I'm scared because she jumps in quickly. We weren't breaking in, we weren't doing anything, we were just running and we got lost. The boy crosses his arms in front of his chest, rocking back on his heels. Didn't see any of the signs outside, huh? No trespassing, authorized personnel only. Hannah looks away. She's nervous, too. I can feel it. Hannah's 1,000 times more confident than I am, but neither of us is used to standing in the open and talking to a boy, especially not a boy guard. And it must have occurred to Hannah that he already has plenty of grounds to arrest us. Must have missed him, she mumbles. Uh-huh. He raises his eyebrows. It's obvious he doesn't believe us, but at least he doesn't look angry. They're pretty subtle, you know, only a few dozen of them. I can see how you might not have noticed. He looks away for a second, squinting, and I get the feeling he's trying to stop himself from laughing. He's not like any guard I've ever seen, at least not the typical guards you see at the border and all around Portland, fat and scowly and old. I think about how sure I was yesterday that he came from the wilds, the solid certainty deep inside of me. I was wrong, obviously. As he turns his head, I see the unmistakable sign of someone who is cured. The mark of the procedure, a 3-pointed scar just behind the left ear, where the scientists insert a special 3-pronged needle used exclusively for immobilizing the patient so that the cure can be administered. People show off their scars like badges of honor. You hardly see any cureds with long hair, and the women who haven't lopped off their hair entirely are careful to wear it pulled back. My fear recedes. Talking to a cured isn't illegal. The rules of segregation don't apply. I'm not sure if he's recognized me or not. If so, he hasn't given any sign of it. Finally, I can't take it anymore, and I burst out, "You! I saw you!" At the last second, I can't finish the sentence, "I saw you yesterday. You winked at me." Hannah looks startled. "You two know each other?" She shoots a look at me. Hannah knows I've hardly ever exchanged 2 words with a boy before, unless it's excuse me in the street or sorry for stepping on your toes when I trip on somebody. We're not supposed to have more than minimal contact with uncured boys outside of our own families. Even after they've been cured, there's hardly a need or excuse for it unless we're dealing with a doctor or teacher or someone like that. He turns to look at me. His face is completely professional and composed, but I swear I see something flickering in his eyes, a look of amusement or pleasure. "No," he says smoothly. "We've never met. I'm sure I would remember." The flash in his eyes is back. Is he laughing at me? "I'm Hannah," Hannah says, "and this is Lena." She jabs me with an elbow. I know I must look like a fish standing there with my mouth gaping open, but I'm too outraged to speak. He's lying. I know he's the one I saw yesterday. Would bet my life on it. "Alex, nice to meet you." Alex keeps his eyes on me as he and Hannah shake hands. Then he extends a hand to me. "Lena," he says thoughtfully. "I've never heard that name before." I hesitate. Shaking hands makes me feel awkward, like I'm playing dress-up in an adult's too-big clothing. Besides, I've never actually touched skin-to-skin with a stranger. But he's just standing there with his hand out, so after a second, I reach out and shake. The moment we touch, A tiny electrical shock buzzes through me and I pull away quickly. It's short for Magdalena, I say. Magdalena. Alex tips his head back, watching me from narrowed eyes. Pretty. I'm momentarily distracted by the way he says my name. In his mouth, it sounds musical, not clunky and angular the way my teachers have always made it sound. His eyes are a warm amber color, and as I look at him, I have a sudden flashing memory of my mother pouring syrup over a stack of pancakes. I look away feeling ashamed, as though he has somehow been responsible for dredging the memory up, has reached in with his hand and wrenched it from me. Embarrassment makes me feel angry, and I press on. I do know you. I saw you yesterday in the labs. You were on the observation deck, watching everything. Again, my courage fails me at the last second, and I don't say watching me. I can feel Hannah glaring at me, but I ignore her. She must be furious I haven't told her any of this. Alex's face doesn't change. He doesn't blink or drop his smile for even a fraction of a second. Case of mistaken identity, I guess. Guards aren't allowed in the labs during evaluations, especially not part-time guards. For a second longer, we stand there staring at each other. Now I know he's lying, and the easy, lazy grin on his face makes me want to reach out and slap him. I ball my fists and suck in a deep breath, willing myself to stay calm. I am not the violent type. I don't know why I'm feeling so aggravated. Hannah jumps in, breaking the tension. So, this is it? A part-time security guard and some keep-out signs? Alex keeps his eyes on me a half second longer. Then he turns to look at Hannah as though noticing her for the first time. What do you mean? I would have thought the labs would be better protected, that's all. It doesn't seem like it would be too hard to break into this place. Alex raises his eyebrows. Thinking about making the attempt? Hannah freezes, and my blood goes to ice. She's gone too far. If Alex reports us as potential sympathizers or troublemakers or anything, we're in for months and months of surveillance and investigation, and we can kiss our chances of passing the evaluations with decent scores goodbye. I picture a lifetime of watching Andrew Marcus fish snot out of his nose with a thumbnail and feel queasy. Alex must sense our fear because he raises both hands. Relax, I was kidding. You don't exactly seem like terrorists. It occurs to me how ridiculous we must look in our running shorts and sweaty tank tops and neon sneakers. Or at least, I must look ridiculous. Hannah looks like a model for athletic wear. Again, I feel a fit of blushing coming on, followed by a surge of irritation. No wonder the regulators decided on the segregation of boys and girls. Otherwise, it would have been a nightmare, this feeling angry and self-conscious and confused and annoyed all the time. This is just the loading area anyway for freight and stuff. Alex gestures beyond the line of cargo sheds. Real security starts closer to the facilities. Full-time guards, cameras, electrified fence, the whole shebang. Hannah doesn't look at me, but when she speaks, I can hear the excitement creeping into her voice. The loading area? Like, where the deliveries come? In my head, I start praying, don't say anything dumb. Don't say anything dumb. Do not mention the invalids. You got it. Hannah dances on her feet, shifting her weight back and forth. I try to shoot her a warning look, but she avoids my eyes. So, this is where the trucks come, with medical equipment and other stuff? Exactly. Again, I have the impression of something flickering behind Alex's eyes, even as the rest of his face stays totally neutral. I don't trust him, I realize, and again wonder why he's lying about being in the labs yesterday. Maybe only because it's forbidden, like he said. Maybe because he was laughing instead of trying to help out. And maybe, after all, he really doesn't recognize me. We made eye contact for only a few seconds, and I'm sure to him I was only a blurry in-between face, easy to forget. Not pretty, not ugly either, just plain, like a thousand other faces you would see on the street. He, on the other hand, is most definitely not in-between. There's something insane to me about standing in the open talking to a strange boy, even if he is cured. And though my head is whirling, it's like my vision gets razor sharp, making everything look ultra detailed. I notice the way a piece of his hair curls around his scar like a frame. I notice his large brown hands and the whiteness of his teeth and the perfect symmetry of his face. His jeans are faded and belted low on his hips, and the laces in his sneakers are the weirdest ink color blue, like he has colored them in with a pen. I wonder how old he is. He looks my age, but he must be slightly older, maybe 19. I wonder, too, a brief, flitting thought, whether he's already been paired. But, of course he has. He must have been. I've been staring at him accidentally, and he turned suddenly to look at me. I drop my eyes, feeling a quick and irrational terror that he has managed to read my thoughts. I'd love to look around, Hannah hints not so subtly. I reach out and pinch her when Alex isn't looking and she shrinks away, giving me a guilty look. At least she doesn't start grilling him about what happened yesterday and get us thrown in jail or dragged through an interrogation. Alex tosses his water bottle in the air, catches it in one hand. Trust me, there's nothing to see. Unless you're a fan of industrial waste. There's plenty of that around here. He tips his head toward the dumpsters. Oh, and the best view of the bay in Portland. We got that going for us, too. Really? Hannah wrinkles her nose, momentarily distracted from her detective mission. Alex nods, tosses the bottle again, catches it. As it arcs through the air, the sun winks through the water like light from a jewel. That I can show you, he says. Come on. All I want is to get out of here, but Hannah says, sure. So I trudge along after her, silently cursing her curiosity and fixation with all things invalid-related and vowing never to let her pick our running route again. She and Alex walk in front, and I pick up scattered bits of their conversation. I hear him say he takes classes at one of the colleges, but miss what he says he studies. Hannah tells him we're about to graduate. He tells her he's 19. She says that we're both turning 18 in several months. Thankfully, they avoid talking about the botched evaluations yesterday. The service road connects with another, smaller drive which runs parallel to 4th Street, slanting steeply uphill toward the eastern promenade. Here there are rows of long metal storage sheds. The sun is flat and high and unrelenting. I'm incredibly thirsty, but when Alex turns around and offers me a sip from his water bottle, I say, no, quickly and too loud. The thought of putting my mouth where his mouth has been makes me feel anxious all over again. As we come up to the top of the hill, all three of us panting a little from the climb, the bay unfolds to our right like a gigantic map, a sparkling, shimmering world of blues and greens. Hannah gasps a little. It really is a beautiful view, unobstructed and perfect. The sky is full of poofy white clouds that make me think of feather pillows, and seagulls turn lazy arcs over the water, patterns of birds forming and dissolving in the sky. Hannah walks forward a few feet. It's amazing. Gorgeous, isn't it? No matter how long I live here, I never get used to it. She turns and looks at me. I think this is my favorite way to see the ocean. Middle of the afternoon, sunny and bright. It's just like a photograph. Don't you think, Lena? I'm feeling so relaxed, enjoying the wind at the top of the hill, which sweeps over my arms and legs and makes me feel cool and delicious. Enjoying the view of the bay and the high, blinking eye of the sun, I've almost forgotten that Alex is with us. He's been hanging back, standing a few feet behind us, and ever since we came up the hill, he hasn't said a word. Which is why I nearly jump out of my skin when he leans forward and directs a single word into my ear. Gray. What? I whirl around, my heart pounding. Hannah has turned back to the water and is going on about wishing she had her camera and how you never seem to have anything you really need. Alex is bent close to me, so close I can see his individual eyelashes like perfect brush strokes on a canvas portrait. And now his eyes are literally dancing with light, burning as though on fire. What did you say? I repeat. My voice comes out a croaky whisper. He leans another inch closer, and it's like the flames seep out of his eyes and light my whole body on fire. I've never been this close to a boy before. I feel like fainting and running all at the same time, but I can't move. I said, I prefer the ocean when it's gray. Or not really gray, a pale, in-between color. It reminds me of waiting for something good to happen. He does remember. He was there. The ground seems to be dissolving under my feet the way it does in the dream about my mother. All I can see are his eyes, the shifting pattern of shadow and light turning there. You lied, I managed to croak out. Why did you lie? He doesn't answer me. He pulls away a few inches and says, Of course, it's even prettier at sunset. Around 8:30, the sky looks like it's on fire, especially at Bat Cove. You should really see it. He pauses, and though his voice is low and casual, I get the feeling he's trying to tell me something important. Tonight, it'll probably be amazing. My brain grinds into action, slowly processing his words the way he's emphasizing certain details. Then it clicks. He has given me a time and a place. He's telling me to meet him. Are you asking me to... I start to say, but just then, Hannah runs back up to me, grabbing my arm. God! She says, laughing. Can you believe it's after 5 already? We've got to go! She's dragging me backward before I can respond or protest, and by the time I think to look over my shoulder to see if Alex is watching or giving me any kind of sign, he has disappeared from view. Chapter 6. Mama, Mama, help me get home. I'm out in the woods. I am out on my own. I found me a werewolf, a nasty old mutt. It showed me its teeth and went straight for my gut. Mama, Mama, help me get home. I'm out in the woods. I am out on my own. I was stopped by a vampire, a rotting old wreck. It showed me its teeth and went straight for my neck. Mama, Mama, put me to bed. I won't make it home. I'm already half dead. I met an invalid and fell for his art. He showed me his smile and went straight for my heart. From A Child's Walk Home, Nursery Rhymes and Folk Tales, edited by Corey Levinson. That evening, I can't concentrate. When I'm setting the table for dinner, I accidentally pour wine in Gracie's juice cup and orange juice in my uncle's wine glass, and while I'm grating cheese, I catch my knuckles so many times in the teeth of the grater, my aunt finally sends me out of the kitchen, saying she'd prefer not to have a topping of skin for her ravioli. I can't stop thinking about the last thing Alex said to me. The endlessly shifting pattern of his eyes, the strange expression on his face like he was inviting me. Around 8:30, the sky looks like it's on fire, especially at Bat Cove. You should really see it. Is it even remotely, conceivably possible he was sending me a message? Is it possible he was asking me to meet him? The idea makes me dizzy. I keep thinking, too, about the single word directed low and quietly straight into my ear. Gray. He was there. He saw me. He remembered me. So many questions crowd my brain at once. It's like one of the famous Portland fogs has swept up from the ocean and settled there, making it impossible to think normal, functional thoughts. My aunt finally notices something's wrong. Just before dinner, I'm helping Jenny with her homework, as always, testing her on her multiplication tables. We're sitting on the floor of the living room, which is squashed up right next to the dining room, an alcove that barely holds a table and 6 chairs. And I'm holding her workbook on my knees, reciting the problems to her. But my mind is on autopilot, and my thoughts are a million miles away. Or rather, they're exactly 3.4 miles away, down at the marshy edge of Back Cove. I know the distance exactly because it's a nice run from my house. Now I'm calculating how quickly I could get down there on my bike, and then beating myself up for even considering the idea. 7 times 8? Jenny pinches her lips together. 56. 9 times 6. 52. On the other hand, there's no law that says you can't speak to a cured. Cures are safe. They can be mentors or guides to the uncureds. Even though Alex is only a year older than I am, we're separated irreparably and totally by the procedure. He might as well be my grandfather. 7 times 11?
77.
Lena, my aunt has squeezed out of the kitchen past the dining room table and is standing behind Jenny. I blink twice, trying to focus. Carol's face is tight with concern.
Is something the matter?
No. I drop my eyes quickly. I hate it when my aunt looks at me like that, like she's reading all the bad parts from my soul. I feel guilty just for thinking about a boy, even a cured one. If she knew, she would say, "Oh, Lena, careful. Remember what happened to your mother?" She would say, "These diseases tend to run in the blood." Why? I keep my eyes trained on the worn carpet underneath me. Carol bends forward, swoops up Jenny's workbook from my knees, and says loudly in her clear, high voice, 9 times 6 is 54. She snaps the workbook closed. Not 52, Lena. I assume you know your multiplication tables? Jenny sticks her tongue out at me. My cheeks start heating up as I realize my mistake. Sorry, I guess I'm just kind of distracted. There's a momentary pause. Carol's eyes never leave the back of my neck. I can sense them burning there. I feel like I'll scream or cry or confess if she keeps staring at me. Finally, she sighs. You're still thinking about the evaluations, aren't you? I blow the air out of my cheeks, feel a weight of anxiety ease off my chest. Yeah, I guess so. I venture a glance up at her, and she smiles her little skittering smile. I know you're disappointed you have to go through the process again, but think about it this way. This time you'll be even more prepared. I bob my head and try to look enthusiastic, even though a little pinching feeling of guilt starts nipping at me. I haven't even thought about the evaluation since this morning, not since I found out the results would be discounted. Yeah, you're right. Come on now, dinner time. My aunt reaches out and passes a finger over my forehead. Her finger is cool and reassuring and gone as quickly as the lightest stirring of wind. It makes the guilt flare up full force, and in that moment, I can't believe I was even considering going to Back Cove. It's the absolute 100% wrong thing to do, and I stand up for dinner feeling clean and weightless and happy, like the first time you feel healthy after a long fever. But at dinner, my curiosity, and with it, my doubts, return. I can barely follow the conversation. All I can think is, go, don't go, go, don't go. At one point, my uncle is telling a story about one of his customers, and I notice everyone is laughing, so I laugh too, but a little too loud and long. Everyone turns to look at me, even Gracie, who puckers her nose and tilts her head like a dog sniffing at something new. Are you okay, Lena? My uncle asks, adjusting his glasses as though hoping to bring me into clearer focus. You seem a little strange. I'm fine. I push around some ravioli on my plate. Normally, I can put away half a box myself, especially after a long run, and still have room for dessert. But I've barely managed to choke down a few bites. Just stressed. Leave her alone, my aunt says. She's upset about the evaluations. They didn't exactly turn out as planned. She lifts her eyes to my uncle, and they exchange a quick glance. I feel a rush of excitement. It's rare for my aunt and uncle to look at each other like that, a wordless glance full of meaning. Most of the time, their interactions are limited to the usual thing. My uncle tells stories about work, my aunt tells stories about the neighbors, what's for dinner, there's a leak in the roof, blah, blah, blah. I think that for once, they're going to mention the Wilds and the invalids. But then my uncle gives a minute shake of his head.
These kinds of mix-ups happen all the time, he says, staking a ravioli with his fork. Just the other day, I asked Andrew to reorder 3 cases of Vic's orange juice, but he goes and gets the codes wrong, and guess what shows up? 3 cases of baby formula. I said, Andrew.
I tune the conversation out again, grateful that my uncle is a talker and happy that my aunt has taken my side. The one good thing about being kind of shy is that nobody bugs you when you want to be left alone. I lean forward and sneak a glance at the clock in the kitchen. 7:30 and we haven't even finished eating. And afterward, I'll have to help clear and wash the dishes, which always takes forever. The dishwasher uses up too much electricity, so we have to do them by hand. Outside, the sun is streaked with filaments of gold and pink. It looks like the candy that gets spun at the sugar shack downtown, all gloss and stretch and color. It will be a beautiful sunset tonight. In that moment, the urge to go is so strong, I have to squeeze the sides of my chair to keep from suddenly springing up and running out the door. Finally, I decide to stop stressing and leave it to luck, or fate, or whatever you want to call it. If we finish eating and I'm done cleaning up the dishes in time to make it to Back Cove, I'll go. If not, I'll stay. I feel a million times better once I've made the decision, and even managed to shovel down a few more bites of ravioli before Jenny, miracle of miracles, has a sudden late burst of speed and cleans her plate, and my aunt announces I can clear the dishes whenever I'm ready. I stand up and start stacking everyone's plates. It's almost 8 o'clock. Even if I can wash all the dishes in 15 minutes, and that's a stretch, it will still be difficult to get to the beach by 8:30, and forget about making it back by 9 o'clock when the city has a mandated curfew for uncureds. And if I got caught on the streets after curfew? The truth is, I don't know what would happen. I've never broken curfew. Just as I've finally accepted that there's no way to get to Back Cove and back in time, my aunt does the unthinkable. As I'm reaching forward to take her plate, she stops me. You don't have to clean the dishes tonight, Lena. I'll do them. As she's speaking, she reaches out and puts a hand on my arm. Just like earlier, the touch is as fleeting and cool as wind. And before I can think about what this means, I'm blurting out, actually, I have to run to Hannah's house really quick. Now? A look of alarm, or suspicion, flickers across my aunt's face. It's nearly 8 o'clock. I know, she has a study guide she was supposed to give me. I just remembered. Now the look of suspicion, it is suspicion, definitely, makes itself comfortable, drawing Carol's eyebrows together, cinching her lips. You don't have any of the same classes, and your boards are over. How important can it be? It's not for class. I roll my eyes, trying to conjure up Hannah's nonchalance, even though my palms are sweating and my heart is jerking around in my chest. It's like a guide full of pointers for the evaluations. She knows I need to prep more since I almost choked yesterday. Again, my aunt directs a small glance at my uncle. Curfew's in an hour, she says to me. If you get caught out after curfew... Nervousness makes my temper flare. I know about curfew, I snap. I've only been hearing about it for my whole life. I feel guilty the second that the words are out of my mouth, and I drop my eyes to avoid looking at Carol. I've never spoken back to her, have always tried to be as patient and obedient and good as possible, have always tried to be as invisible as possible. A nice girl who helps with the dishes and the little kids and does her homework and listens and keeps her head down. I know that I owe Carol for taking Rachel and me in after my mother died. If it wasn't for her, I'd probably be wasting away in one of the orphanages, uneducated, unnoticed, destined for a job at a slaughterhouse, probably, cleaning up sheep guts or cow crap or something like that. Maybe, if I was lucky, I'd get to work for a cleaning service. No foster parent will adopt a child whose past has been tainted by the disease. I wish I could read her mind. I have no idea what she's thinking, but she seems to be analyzing me, attempting to read my face. I think, I'm not doing anything wrong, it's harmless, I'm fine. Over, and wipe my palms on the back of my jeans, positive I'm leaving a sweat mark. Be quick, she says finally, and as soon as the words are out of her mouth, I'm off, jetting upstairs and switching my sandals for sneakers. Then I bang back down the stairs and fly out the door. My aunt has barely had time to take the dishes into the kitchen. She calls something to me as I blur past her, but I'm already pushing out the front door and don't catch what she says. The ancient grandfather clock in the living room starts booming out just as the screen door swings shut behind me. 8 o'clock. I unlock my bike and pedal it down the front path and out into the street. The pedals creak and moan and shudder. This bike was owned by my cousin Marcia before me and must be at least 15 years old, and leaving it outside all year isn't doing anything to preserve it. I start cruising in the direction of Back Cove, which is downhill, fortunately. The streets are always pretty empty at this time of night. For the most part, the cureds are inside, sitting at dinner or cleaning up or preparing for bed and another night of dreamless sleep. And all the uncureds are home or on their way there, nervously watching the minutes swirl away toward 9 o'clock curfew. My legs are still aching from my run earlier today. If I make it to Back Cove on time and Alex is there, I'm going to be a complete mess, sweaty and disgusting. But I keep going anyway. Now that I'm out of the house, I push all my doubts and questions out of my mind and focus on hauling ass as fast as my cramping legs will allow me, spinning down through the vacant streets toward the cove, taking every shortcut I can think of, watching the sun descend steadily toward the blazing gold line of the horizon as though the sky, a brilliant electric blue at this point, is water and the light is just sinking through it. I've only been out at this hour a few times on my own, and the feeling is strange, frightening, and exhilarating at the same time, like talking to Alex out in the open earlier this afternoon, as though the revolving eye that I know is always watching has been blinded just for a fraction of a second, as though the hand you've been holding your whole life suddenly disappears and leaves you free to move in any direction you want. Lights sputter in windows around me. Candles and lanterns, mostly. This is a poor area, and everything is rationed, especially gas and electricity. At a certain point, I lose sight of the sun's position beyond the 4- and 5-story buildings, which grow more densely packed after I turn onto Preble. Tall, skinny, dark buildings pressed up against one another as though already preparing for winter and huddling for warmth. I haven't really thought about what I'll say to Alex. And the idea of standing alone with him suddenly makes my stomach bottom out. I have to pull my bike up abruptly, stop and catch my breath. My heart is pounding frantically. After a minute's rest, I keep pedaling, slower now. I'm still about a mile away, but the cove is visible, flashing off to my right. The sun is just teetering over the dark mass of trees on the horizon. I have 10-15 minutes tops until total darkness. Then another thought nearly stops me, hitting me straight like a fist. He won't be there. I'll be too late, and he'll leave. Or this will turn out to be a big joke or a trick. I wrap one arm around my stomach, willing the ravioli to stay put, and pick up speed again. I'm so busy circling one foot after the other, left, right, left, right, and doing a mental tug of war with my digestive tract, that I don't hear the regulators coming. I'm about to speed through the long-defunct traffic light at Baxter when I am suddenly dazzled by a wall of zipping, bouncing light. The beams of a dozen flashlights directed into my eyes, so I have to skid abruptly to a halt, lifting a hand to my face and nearly flipping over the handlebars, which would be a real disaster, since in my rush to get out of the house, I forgot to bring my helmet. "Stop!" the voice of one of the regulators barks out. The leader in charge of the patrol, I guess. "Identity check!" Groups of regulators, both volunteer citizens and the actual regulators employed by the government, patrol the streets every night, looking for uncureds breaking curfew, checking the streets and, if the curtains are open, houses for unapproved activity, like two uncureds touching each other or walking together after dark or even two cureds engaging in activity that might signal the reemergence of the deliria after the procedure, like too much hugging and kissing. This rarely happens, but it does happen. Regulators report directly to the government and work closely with the scientists at the labs. Regulators were responsible for sending my mother off for her 3rd procedure. A passing patrol saw her crying over a photograph one night right after her 2nd failed treatment. She was looking at a picture of my father, and she'd forgotten to close the curtains all the way. Within days, she was back at the labs. Normally, it's easy to avoid the regulators. You can practically hear them from a mile away. They carry walkie-talkies to coordinate with other patrolling groups, and the static interference of the radios going on and off makes it sound like a giant buzzing den of hornets is heading your way. I just wasn't paying attention. Mentally cursing myself for being so stupid, I fished my wallet out of my back pocket. At least I remembered to grab that. It's illegal to go without ID in Portland. The last thing anybody wants is to spend the night in jail while the powers that be try to verify your validity. "Magdalena Ella Holloway," I say, trying to keep my voice steady as I pass my ID to the regulator in charge. I can hardly make him out, behind his flashlight, which he keeps trained on my face, forcing me to squint. He's big, that's all I know. tall, thin, angular.
Magdalena Ella Holloway, he repeats.
He flips my ID over between his long fingers and looks at my identity code, a number assigned to every citizen of the USA. The first three digits identify your state, the next three your city, the next three your family group, the next four your identity.
And what are you doing, Magdalena? Curfew's in less than 40 minutes.
Less than 40 minutes? That must mean it's almost 8:30. I shift on my feet, trying hard not to betray impatience. A lot of the regulators, especially the volunteer ones, are poorly paid city techs, window washers or gas meter readers or security guards. I take a deep breath and say as innocently as possible, I wanted to take a quick ride down to Back Cove. I do my best to smile and look kind of stupid. I was feeling bloaty after dinner. No point in lying any more than that. I'll just get myself in trouble. The lead regulator continues to examine me, the flashlight directed glaringly at my face, my ID card in his hand. For a second, he seems to waver, and I'm sure he's gonna let me go. But then he passes my ID to another regulator.
Run it through with SVS, will you? Make sure it's valid.
My heart plummets. SVS is the Secure Validation System, a computer network where all the valid citizenships for every single person in the entire country are stored. It can take 20 to 30 minutes for the computer system to match codes, depending on how many other people are calling into the system. He can't really think I forged an identity card, but he's going to waste my time while someone checks. And then, miraculously, a voice pipes up from the back of the group.
She's valid, Jerry. I recognize her. She comes into the store, lives at 172 Cumberland.
Jerry swings around, lowering his flashlight in the process. I blink away the floating dots in my vision. I recognize a few faces vaguely. A woman who works in the local dry cleaners and spends her afternoons leaning in the doorway, chewing gum, and occasionally spitting out into the street. The traffic officer who works downtown near Franklin Arterial, one of the few areas of Portland that has enough car traffic to justify one. One of the guys who collects our garbage. And there in the back, Dev Howard, who owns the Quick Mart down the street from my house. Normally, my uncle brings home most of our groceries, canned goods and pasta and sliced meats, for the most part, from his combo deli and convenience store Stop and Save, all the way over on Munjoy Hill, but occasionally, if we're desperate for toilet paper or milk, I'll run out to the Quick Mart. Mr. Howard has always creeped me out. He's super skinny and has hooded black eyes that remind me of a rat's. But tonight, I feel like I could hug him. I didn't even think he knew my name. He's never said a word to me except, "Will that be all today?" after he has rung up my purchases, glowering at me from underneath the heavy shade of his eyelids. I make a mental note to thank him the next time I see him. Jerry hesitates for a fraction of a second longer, but I can see that the other regulators are starting to get restless, shifting from foot to foot, eager to continue the patrol and find someone to bust. Jerry must sense it too, because he jerks his head abruptly in my direction.
Let her have the ID.
Relief makes me feel like laughing, and I have to struggle to look serious as I take my ID and tuck it into place. My hands are shaking ever so slightly. It's strange how being around the regulators will do that to you. Even when they're being relatively nice, you can't help but think of all the bad stories you've heard. The raids and the beatings and the ambushes.
Just be careful, Magdalena, Jerry says as I straighten up. Make sure you're home before curfew.